Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Coming up on the program this week, imagine giving a teenager a credit card. He may think this is all one big recipe for disaster. If you're worried that giving your teen a credit card will lead to overspending and bad credit scores, think again. Rob Carrick, personal finance columnist for the Globe and Mail, will tell us why he believes helping your teen get a credit card may not be so bad after all. Then, finding the perfect home is the furthest thing from being simple, especially when you have to consider things like the neighborhood and the schools in the area. School Q may be the solution to all your problems. It's a new online resource that provides a ton of data on different neighborhoods and schools across the country. Co-founder and chief marketing officer Carolyn Keesh tells us more. And what's math got to do with music? Apparently, plenty. If you're a musician, you might want to make math your new best friend. Vanessa Vicaria, musician and founder and CEO of The Math Guru, is here with some math tips crucial for anyone in the industry. Plus, paying off your student loans, GiveLing, a fun online trivia game that gives you a chance to win daily cash prizes, all with the purpose of helping you pay off your student debt. Plus, Steve Bridge, certified financial planner and money coach on retirement myths and pitfalls. All that's ahead. Let's get started. Teens and credit cards. Does this sound like a dangerous combination to you? Like, I don't know, vodka and teens? Giving a teen a credit card could be a good idea, but it could also lead to overspending and like ruining their credit scores. I don't know. Rob Carrick believes there is some merit to this idea, and he has personal experience. He is also the personal finance columnist for the Globe and Mail, and he joins us now to tell you why you should consider giving your teen a credit card. Hello there. This is not a theoretical opinion. You did this with your kids?
I did, and you know what? But I'm a convert, because I have to explain that I used to think it was just the dumbest idea to give credit cards to teens. I was once in the Eaton Center in Toronto in late August with my whole family, and we walked by this kiosk, one of the big banks, and they were practically grabbing up young people and foisting credit cards on them. And I was just completely disgusted. I thought it was predatory behavior. And then our boys, they're now 22 and 25, got to be about 18, 19, 20. They started university, and I thought, a credit card is kind of essential in today's economy. You need it to buy goods and services online. I mean, like most young people do most of their purchasing of school supplies and stuff online, or at least a lot of it. And I thought, you know what? A, it's necessary for the economy, and B, they're learning good credit card maintenance techniques. And of course, I was watching over their shoulders all the time to keep them on the straight and narrow.
Yeah.
But a couple of years later, I think they've got the message. You use a card for payments, not as a loan, and they're paying off what they owe, and they're building good credit scores.
And this was their own card. This was not a card that linked back to you.
This was their own card. Now, the banks are very, very liberal in handing cards out to students, but they don't have very big spending limits, like $500 might be a typical amount. But it's very easy for a student to get one. If you've got, if you're a post-secondary student and you have one of your bank's student bank accounts, it should be no problem to get a credit card.
And they need to be the age majority in the province that they live in, right?
Age of majority, but there's no real, so far as I know, I don't recall them being asked to document any employment income or anything like that.
How do you do it right? What is critical in terms of, setting expectations, training? I mean, surely your boys knew that if they screwed this up, you were not going to swoop in and mindlessly cut a check to bail them out.
Well, you know what? I didn't want to come down like a heavy and say, use this right or else. I just said, here's how it works. And here's how I do it. I don't ever wait till the end of the month to pay for all these accumulated purchases, because at the end of the month, I might not have enough money to pay for all the stuff I've been buying gradually. So I go use a pay-as-you-go system. And that way, as it comes to the end of the month, the balance is paid off. And I encourage them to do the same thing. And that's what they're actually doing. And because of that, they've more or less stayed on the straight and narrow.
Did you have a conversation with them about your credit score? Because it's so hard for young people in so many areas to imagine their life 5 or 10 years from now. You know, the kind of stuff that they post to Instagram, you think, geez, like at one point you're going to be an employee trying to get a job, or a young person trying to get a job, and that photo is going to come up on a search. It's very hard for them to think into the future. How did you address that, or how should parents address that notion as it relates to the credit score?
Well, I think, you know what, when I got into this with the boys back, you know, let's say 5 or 6 years ago, credit scores were just only beginning to become as prominent and widely understood as they are now. And the reason for that is because there's more and more services making credit scores easily available at no cost. It used to be sort of this hidden in a vault kind of number that most people never knew. Now you just go on any number of websites, you can get it for free in about 3 seconds. So what I've done since that time is I've explained to them that you want a mortgage, or you want a car loan, they're going to look at your credit score. That's going to determine how good an interest rate you get. And a little TLC in terms of using your credit card and managing your credit, and you will never have to worry about your credit score. You know, the fact is that most Canadians actually have a very good credit score on average. I was just looking at some numbers. I was bowled over. It's not really a big issue, which tells me most people are already doing a good job, and most people don't need to be worried that kids are going to blow their brains out credit score-wise. I don't think that's going to happen. I've actually seen numbers that go back a few years that showed students with credit cards were actually a little better than the broader population at paying what they owe.
What sort of advice do you have on monitoring the card usage? So we think about young people, like tweens, and device use. A lot of parents say, listen, you should know that I'm going to go into your phone at any time, and I'm going to look at your texts, I'm going to look at your Instagram. I need to know that. You don't have privacy on that device. How should parents approach that when it comes to a credit card? Do you go that route and say, I'm going to look at it all? Or do you say, listen, as long as you're paying it, I'm not going to pay any attention unless a bank calls me to complain about you?
Well, I took a collaborative point of view. I said, here's the credit card. You've only got like $500 worth of rope here. And when over time, I would say, how is your credit card doing? Are you carrying a balance? How's it going? Are you finding that you're able to pay as you go along? And I just asked him. We had a conversation about it. And, you know, I heard, you know, at certain points, one of my boys would carry a balance for a little while. But I always got on him. And, you know, the problem seemed to take care of itself. We never allowed it to snowball to a point where it became unmanageable. But it was coaching and collaboration rather than being draconian or warning about consequences and all that sort of thing. But every parent has a different relationship with their kids, and they feel they want to handle these lessons differently. But that's what worked for me.
You put this topic up on your Facebook page. What kind of responses did you receive?
A lot of people said, yes, I'm doing that with my child. A lot of parents seem to realize the importance of this, that, you know what, when you look at the amount of bullying going on in the population, there must be a lot of parents who think, okay, I got a little out of hand on my bullying. I do not want my kids to be in that position. There's other parents who are very good with money and they want their kids to be the same way, but they're all ending up at the same place thinking, I have to teach my kids how to use credit cards. And let's be honest, credit cards are becoming more and more prominent in our lives. People are getting more and more focused on the reward points, and they want to use credit cards as a means to get these reward points. This trend is, if anything, gathering more momentum, and I think they're just recognizing that credit cards are a key tool that adults use to manage their finances, and I want my kid to be savvy about them.
There are other options in our cashless world. You could help them get a debit card. You could help them get a prepaid card. What are the downsides to those two options that have the credit card be the better one?
Well, you know what, if your kid is going out of town for university, I think this is the inflection point where a lot of parents get involved and start to understand all this. You probably want to have your kid go off out of town with a credit card that they could use, for example, if their car broke down or if they need to buy travel online. You're going to probably need a credit card. Now, you can use debit online to some extent, but I think a credit card is really necessary. Try to rent a car online with a debit card. I think a credit card is a important financial tool, and I don't think really that you can cover it off 100% of the time with debit or with prepaid cards.
What is a good example of when not to give a teen a credit card or encourage them to get one, because you're not actually giving it to them? They're going to have to sign up for it and take the liability themselves. Are there other things that you look and you go, they're just not a responsible human being. This isn't going to be a good fit for them.
Well, you know, I think, you know what, everybody has a different money personality, and you can change behavior, but everybody has their own innate way of handling things before they absorb all the tips and everything else. Some people are very careful. Some are oblivious to the idea that this isn't free money, or maybe it's wishful thinking. I don't know. I think maybe if you have a kid who is really, you know, not tuned into managing money, you might have a, you might decide A, not to do it, B, to go with the prepay card, B, to have the credit card issued as sort of a secondary account on your own card account. But you have to up your level of scrutiny if you give such a kid a card. In fact, it might be, you could argue that it's all the more important to get someone like that on the right track. And so how would you approach that? I mean, what I might do is go have a week-by-week review, you know what, or give them a few months and see how they're doing with it. This might be the tool that gets them on track. I don't know. But I don't think that you could write someone off and say, you know what, they're bad with money as a child because they spent all their allowance on candy so they could never have a credit card. These people will get credit cards eventually. Would you rather it happen under your supervision and with your guidance or later on without, and you know, there's no safety net?
100% agree. And hopefully the credit card piece is the just the next chapter in financial literacy and financial education that began when they were 4 or 5.
Yes, 4 or 5. You know, and now more and more high school classes in grades 9 through 12 are delving into financial literacy. And one of the best messages they could teach people was that paying 19 or 20 or 21% interest on a credit card is about the worst thing you can do in personal finance.
That is about, I would agree with you. That is about the worst. Rob, thanks so much for your time.
Anytime, Chris.
Rob Carrick, personal finance columnist for the Globe and Mail. He was here to talk to us about teens and credit cards.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Realtors selling to families know that the quality of the local school matters. It can matter a lot. But how do you determine the quality of the one near where you're looking to buy? School Q claims to help you find the answer. The company's co-founder and chief marketing officer, Carolyn Keesh, joins us now. Hello there.
Hi.
How does this system work? I went on, I checked out my neighborhood and my local schools, but tell them how it works.
Sure. So schoolq.ca is a website that was launched very recently on August the 15th, and it's designed so that home buyers can go and get the sweet spot of finding the right school, the best school for their children in the right neighborhood with a home that has the features and that they can afford. And currently, we've heard from frustrated moms who have to go to many, many, many different websites to pull all of that information together. So we've curated all of that information so it's a one-stop source.
Moms and dads. I'm sure dads are frustrated too.
Yes.
Where does the data come from?
So we have a service, HoodQ, and we are Canada's largest aggregator and curator of address and school reports in Canada. And we pull from 2,500 data sources, unique data sources, to get all of that information.
So for residents of Ontario, one of the ones that people would know is the Fraser Institute.
That's
so there's
right.
a school ranking in Ontario. In other parts of the country, where does that equivalent data come from?
So we have raw assessment data across all of the provinces, and then we translate that data to create our own school Q scores. It's a direct translation of the raw assessment data at a provincial level.
So the student scores part, I understand. Then there is some metrics around student population scores, like percentage of students who are new to Canada, special ed, low-income households. How does that data affect the score?
That particular data doesn't affect the score.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that is just population information so that you know what the type of demographic, yeah, of that
particular. And what do you think
school.
A buyer should or could infer from that data?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because one of the things that we are doing right now is a school Q, take the school Q challenge. And this is a challenge to all of the teachers and principals across Canada to give us more information and say why your school is so amazing. So we have a mantra that is, a school is more than a score. Right now, in the absence of other information, that's what educators and parents are kind of forced to rely on, right, is school scores. But we know, and we've heard certainly from real estate agents and parents, that it's not all of it. In fact, it often is a very poor misrepresentation of how good the school is.
Because I looked at the student population data and I thought, is that racist? Is that racist? And I'm not sure. I'm not making a declaration either way. I think some people would say, I want to be in a diverse neighborhood. I do not want Whitey Whiterson. And it's helpful to me that we've got something that's going to be more representative of Canada as a whole. And other people who would look at that data and say, no, I want X, Y, and Z. Did you have an ethical debate about how to include that or what context you would need to provide around it?
Absolutely not. We include everything. And the reason is that we've been told that schools are the most important aspect when looking for a home. And so we did a lot of research to find what is important. And we know it's schools, school scores, parks and rec, transit, safety, which is the nearest hospital, police, fire station, convenience, like all of this. And so we, because we have the data, we put it all in one source.
How did you determine how to weight the data? What mattered the most?
We don't get to weight the data. When a user comes onto SchoolQ, they can filter by what's most relevant to them. So when they go on they can start the search by going into a city, or they can start by
which
going
I did.
Right
I went to my neighborhood and I saw my school, and it was 7.2.
Right.
But how is that weighted? I assume there's more than one variable in there.
Oh, you mean the actual school score?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is the raw assessment data that we
just
translate.
Academic scores.
Yeah, we translate.
It's the only
it.
Thing.
Yeah, and then we, as you probably saw on that profile page, we include a ton of other information from the school in addition to the score, because the school is more than
But the score is only the students on standardized tests.
That's right.
I see.
Yeah.
Now, you make money by having relationships with realtors.
That's right.
So a realtor at the end of my thing, there was a realtor. I see her in the neighborhood. I know who she is. They pay what, $200 to $500?
That's right.
Is it a membership or is it per lead?
It is per month, and it's for a one-year contract. And what that ensures is that when we have home buyers coming onto the site, if they want to ask a question, we want to make sure that it's a very good realtor who's able to provide the customer service that we're looking for.
How do you assess them?
We interview them.
And what do you ask?
Every single one. Well, we make sure that, one, they are a top realtor. They do many deals a year. We make sure that they have a good customer service record, that they have a good brand in the marketplace, so that people, you know, if you picked a different neighborhood like Riverdale or High Park, that you would not be surprised that that person is the neighborhood expert, that they do already a lot of business in.
And do they get exclusivity for that?
They do, yes. Yes, they do. And so when someone comes onto the site, if they want to request a report, I should say that, because we offer free reports, address reports and school reports and neighborhood reports for every neighborhood across 2,400 neighborhoods in 130 cities.
Wow.
So
it's a lot of data.
It's a lot of data. And we offer everything on the site is free, including the reports. So when someone requests that report, they are given the report with the realtor. If they want to follow up, it's up to them.
At the beginning, you talked about schools and the connection that they have to the price of homes. One of the challenges in expensive markets is that you really, really have to pay up for a great school. At what point is that not the smartest thing to do?
Yeah, so we have, that's a great question. We have on our on schoolq.ca a way that you can filter by the criteria of that meshes what you can afford, so the home filter,
right,
as well as the home type, if you like, and at the same time you can see the schools near that. So I think that, you know, if you find that you can't actually afford that neighborhood, you can go from detached to semi-attached. Now can you afford it? Okay, not semi.
I will live in 300 square feet, but my kid will go to the best school in the country.
So you can change. You can change the filters. It's dynamic. It's live. You just change it until you can afford it. If you can't afford it, then you stay on the SchoolQ site and go to another neighborhood.
And drive 4 hours to work every single day.
There you go.
Right. Carolyn, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Carolyn Keish, Chief Marketing Officer, co-founder of SchoolQ. It's a really interesting resource for families looking to understand neighborhoods better and determine whether that amazing school is worth the price of that really expensive house. Coming up next, Vanessa Vaccaria, math guru and musician, tells us why math is important for anyone in the music industry. And later, Steve Bridge, certified financial planner, money coach. He'll take us through some common retirement myths and pitfalls. To listen to full episodes of the show, you can go to our website, moolala.ca, or just call up one of your podcast providers and download the full podcast, individual segments. And while you're there, write us a review. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Math and music. There's a connection here. Trust me. Did you know that Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, and the entire K-pop band BTS were all members of their high school math club? Did you know this?
Know that.
Vanessa didn't know this.
Oh, my God.
That's because I'm lying. I totally made it up.
Oh.
Totally made it up. Regardless of your passions, your job, your position on Billboard's Top 100, math is a big part of our everyday lives. Vanessa Vaccaria, musician and founder and CEO of The Math Guru, is here to tell us why math should be a musician's best friend. I'm so glad I hoodwinked you on that. That makes me very happy.
I was like, oh my God, I need to start posting about this. They are role models. I need them to come speak.
He's a journalist. He can be trusted.
And I was like, this is reason number 102. I want to be the next Lady Gaga.
You are math tutor by day, musician by night. You opened for Bon Jovi.
We did.
How does that even happen?
Okay, well, you know how that happens? It is luck.
Did you win a contest on the radio?
No, we didn't win a contest. And I'm going to say this so quickly because I feel everyone needs to know how great Bon Jovi is.
Yes.
The guy, being the great guy he is for this entire tour that he's doing, every town he goes to, he finds a local band to open for him to give them the break he got when he was starting out.
Amazing.
Is that not insane? And we got picked and it was amazing. The best. Like, it was everything you're imagining right now. Like, are you getting goosebumpy? It was lovely.
Yeah,
and we
totally
found out.
Well, I've seen it online. It's amazing.
Oh my God. And it was 3 days before. We found out on a Wednesday and they were like, Saturday, we need you to play the
ACC. I would have to be off solid food. I would just, because I'd just be hurling every single minute of every day with crazy nerves. Why do you think many musicians and artists believe they can't do math? Because you kind of straddle two very different worlds.
I'm so glad you asked this. Okay, so I actually think, like, I think the reason for me, I thought forever that I couldn't do math, and it's because I was not only labeled a creative, but I labeled myself a creative.
Right. I'm creative, therefore.
Therefore, and you know, in society, there's always that thing. I'm an artsy person,
right,
or I'm like a mathy logical person. You always hear people say that. So I think what happens is we are forced to choose without even knowing there's a choice to be made.
Right. Musicians, you would argue, need math or could use math in the way that they think about their careers. How come?
Absolutely. First of all, everyone needs math. But musicians, I think, especially need math because I think they're actually at risk of getting taken advantage of because everyone thinks that they have no idea what's going on.
Right.
So whether it comes to managers, producers, show booking, royalties, people think it's easy to pull a fast one over them. And that is why it's not the only reason why, but the broke musician is a trope that continues.
Right.
Right. And because musicians feel they can't do it math, they're treated like they can't do math.
And it's a harder game now for many musicians than it was even 10 years ago because you make for every 10,000 streams you get on Spotify, you get what, 3 cents or something like
that?
4 cents?
It's something like that. It's something very, very low. And now there are a lot of ways you need to be crafty about making money. There are a lot more ways to make money, actually, right? It's not just about people buying your albums. There are SoCan royalties. Every time you play a show, you can submit a set list and get money. Like, there are all these little things, but if you're afraid of math, you're not even going to look into that stuff.
Well, the reason we're having this conversation is you had a thing with, I think it was a law firm on some of the things that musicians needed to learn. You mentioned SoCan royalties. You also mentioned recoupable expenses and paying producers and advances. Like, these are the kinds of things that musicians should know about?
Absolutely. And I would say, if to start with something as simple as, is the show you're booking worth playing? Right? Often you're like, oh my gosh, awesome, we're going to go play the show, we're getting paid like $100. How much is it costing you to put on that show? Right? Like, are you actually making any money? When you're planning a tour, like, thinking about things like transportation, does it make more sense to, like, buy that 10-seat passenger van, or should you really work out a deal with, like, your local car rental company?
Are you saying I have to charge my entourage to join me on tour?
It would honestly...
Because they're just my best friends from high school. I just like having them around.
Right, and that probably is costing you.
I'm not going to do that anymore. Now, for musicians who know you as a musician, do they find it odd...
Oh, my God.
...that you run a math... tutoring company?
So you know what I hear? Like, what? Literally, this has been, we've been a band for 8 years. Every time I get off stage, someone inevitably is like, but what do you do in real life? Because they all know that musicians don't make any money.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, well, actually, I own this math tutoring company. Every time, picture the look they're giving me, and they're like, but you don't look like a math person. And every time I'm like, hey, Vanessa, take a deep breath. Let's debunk the myth. But yes, absolutely. I get it all the time.
So to the musician or to the creative type who may be fully empowered by that label, because many people are, like, they feel like it's their self-expression and people get them because they're an artistic sensibility. What would you say to them about this idea that they might not have the predisposition to do math?
Okay, well, I think I would actually say just something that you say a lot on the podcast, which is you don't need calculus, right, to make money as a musician. You need basic math skills. All the concepts you just mentioned, most of them are actually just percentages.
Right.
We're literally talking about percentages, which are used in elementary school. And I would like to say to anyone out there who was like, but I never got it, I was bad at math, most of you are adults now, right? You're past the age of 15, let's even say.
Yeah.
And the things that you learned in elementary school, I promise you, will be easier when you go back and learn them now. You've been through way harder stuff. If you've played a show and if you're in the industry, you've been working with a lot of harder things than percentages. So I promise you, you can learn them, and I promise you they will make a difference.
Now, Bon Jovi was a huge event for you, I am sure. Mm-hmm. From a mathematical perspective, was it worth your time and energy?
Okay, so this is more complex math, because now we're calculating like opportunity cost and like future dividends, because really opening for Bon Jovi, we didn't get paid. It was an incredible opportunity, but we actually made quite a bit of money off of SoCan, because we only played 4 songs, but the way SoCan works, we're not going to get into the whole like shebang, but you get a percentage of that every time you play those publicly and there is an audience. So we actually got paid way more than we've ever made from any show in that. But then also a show like that, you know, you're going to get future shows from that. You know, you're going to start your, like, that's
it's exposure that counts.
Absolutely.
Because what I hear from artists is that oftentimes the pitch to invite someone to appear is, this is great exposure for you to do this gig at the Chartwell Retirement Home near Zurich, Ontario, because they're like big music listeners and it's so going to be worth. So how do you as an artist make that call? Because you can do the math.
Well, and I mean, we have to make, I mean, again, it's been 8 years and we have played a lot of shows for exposure that never quite materialized. Right. So I think it's something you have to learn, right? It really is something for all beginning artists. Like, you do play a few shows like that, but I think you just start to learn quickly and to pay attention. And thinking about how exposure translates into money is important, right? Like, exposure, how are you going to get fans that are going to follow you? Is the retirement home, maybe they all really like physical, like, vinyl. Maybe they actually will buy a ton of your vinyl because they're, like, you know.
Right, and they're on a fixed income. They don't get out much.
Right.
This is a place for them to spend.
So you've got to really think about it. Talking to other artists that have played the similar venue or show and asking them what it really did for them is a really good strategy.
Where do the majority of working musicians make their music money, their music income? Because, you know, they're not headlining at Scotiabank Arena or wherever the big venues are all the time. Mm-hmm. Are they making money for selling CDs at the back? Is it t-shirts? Is it weddings?
Right. This is wedding musicians make so much money.
They do, eh?
I know a ton of musicians who have like their band and then they have a wedding band as a side project, which is how they make their income.
And they call it something different because they don't want to denigrate the brand.
Of course. And you just play a bunch of covers. Oh my God, you make so much
money. Salt and Pepper's Push It. Yeah. Is what you should play.
Obviously.
Yeah.
But honestly, there are a lot of ways to make money as a musician. One of the biggest ways is actually sync licensing. And that's, you know.
Sync, like license your kitchen sink. So someone comes by and uses your sink and does the dishes in your sink. So I don't think that's what you mean.
You know, the music you have at the beginning of the podcast should be my band's music, because then I would be making money every time you played it.
Right.
So there are a lot of companies that do this. If you have music recorded, you can send it to these companies and they will try and place it for you. So that's a big way I know a lot of musicians make money. Also, grants. There are actually a lot of grants for artists, so to look into that. And then performances is the next way. And then merch, right? But like music, your actual music, selling it is the least way you're going to make money.
Right. Fascinating. I hope you use that in your tutoring with these young, impressionable minds.
I hope you use my music.
Okay. Maybe you could compose something called Moolala.
Oh my God.
It needs to be smart, effervescent, and fun, which is really how I describe myself. And the music needs to be
that way. That's exactly what you're
There's
like.
The brief. Vanessa Vicaria, musician and founder of The Math Guru, a math tutoring company. You've heard her on the show before. You might hear her again. Maybe it's the music, or maybe I'll just invite her back for a chat too. Coming up later on the program, we're going to take Vanessa through the Moolala questionnaire. But next, we'll talk to Seth Beard about Givling. It's an app that lets you play your way out of student debt. Let's talk book club. Seriously, if you're in a book club, you've already read The Life of Pi, right? And The Secret Life of Bees. You've done all that. How about reading Moolala? Oh, yeah. Get it from the library. Download it. There is a discussion guide, especially for book clubs. I was prescient. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Imagine winning the lottery. Now, think about the first thing you would do with that money after you sent me 10% of it, because, of course, that's the first thing you would do. Would you buy a new car, a fancy house, maybe even your own personal island? I don't know. That sounds great, but if you're a college or university graduate and you won the lottery, if it was relatively recently that you got that diploma, I bet the first thing you do is pay off your student loans, because they can be onerous. Givling is an app that helps with that. It's an online trivia game that allows users to win daily cash prizes specifically to pay off their student loans. Joining us now to tell us more about the app is Givling's chief marketing officer, Seth Beard. He joins us now from Los Angeles. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me on the show.
We know student debt is an enormous problem in Canada and the U.S. Why did you decide to create this app?
Well, if you looked out in the marketplace, there were people that were struggling with student loan debt. Now, Givling was started about 4 or 5 years ago when people almost suffered in silence with this debt. It wasn't forefront like you see it in today's politics. People didn't really have a community to go to. So Givling was founded to unite people in this community that they are struggling with a common cause and try to find a way that we could source the crowd for relief. And that's where Givling's idea was emerged. And here we are today, almost $4.5 million paid out to our users in relief.
How does it work?
Yeah, so it's quite simple for anybody that has a smartphone. You can download the app directly on your phone. And it's true or false based trivia. So you have a 50-50 chance on the trivia. And it's the whole gambit of anything that you can kind of imagine of questions. So if you're a math guru or maybe a science guru or just like pop culture, there's a little bit of something for everyone.
How does it work that you can award almost $5 million in cash? What's the model here?
Yeah, so there's a few different revenue sources that Givling has. Each day, the users can play the game twice for free. And if they want to play more times, they can actually purchase additional times to play, which does help fund these payouts. We have advertisers on our platform, one of them being SiriusXM, which has been great, and they've sponsored some of our loan payoffs as well, and a few other ad opportunities that the users can watch ads and generate income that way that we use and pay that back out to them.
What's the range on payouts? Like, what's the most amount you could win, and what's the average amount one would win?
Right. So each day we have a $500 daily cash prize. And all you have to do to be eligible for that is play 10 games within 30 days. So it's very simple to be eligible for that. And then about every week, we do a $10,000 random drawing. And now this one is used towards a student loan or a mortgage. So that one, again, is the same criteria, 10 games played within 30 days. And then our big monster prize is $50,000 toward a student loan.
And how does someone win that one?
Yeah, so that one, it takes a bit more time because there is a queue for that. And they collect these points on our platform by watching ads, playing the game, inviting friends, and various other methods. And once they get to the top and we completely fund one of those loans, it goes into the next person to be funded.
We do a lot of work on behavioral finance and different nudges and how financial institutions are using that framework to help people get a better handle on your money. It seems to me like you're doing the opposite. You're incenting people to gamble. Defend yourself.
No, so it's not a gambling app. It's a trivia game in which people, it's a game of skill. So that's very different than a game of chance. And some of our players are very generous when they do play the game. So crowdfunding is essentially an amazing vehicle that helps us, you know, get to almost $4.5 million paid out to date.
Who owns you? Are you still founder owned, or are you going to, you know, are you owned by some big multinational who's going to take my data and use it to crush my soul?
No, we're completely bootstrapped, actually. So our founder is Lisbeth Pratt, and she has self-funded the GiveLean platform all by herself.
What's its expansion plan globally? Right now, you're principally in the U.S.?
That's correct. So we do know, yeah, up in Canada, last I read, it's about a $28 billion issue with student loan. That was an article from last year. So obviously, I'd assume it's increased there. And other English-speaking areas and our friends over in the UK are struggling with student loan debt. So there are opportunities for us to eventually bring that elsewhere outside the United States.
I wanted to, even though it's not accessible to Canadians, I did want to do this interview because I think it's such a fascinating angle on it. If it were someone with a real financial literacy bent, there would be content associated with dealing with student debt. Is that a part of the platform, or are you saying, no, we're just going to have some fun, some true false questions, maybe you'll win some money, maybe you won't, or do you have a range of content that people can access?
GiveLean does have some content in there in terms of questions that deal around student loan debt, but also we have partners such as SoFi and LendKey who help our users with student loan debt refinance that to more reasonable rates, and they have quite a bit of different literature for the students with these loans that can help them navigate the ins and outs, because it is quite complicated here in the U.S. with various loans, if they can be refinanced, can you refinance a refinance loan, which you can, and all the ins and outs if you're even eligible for public service forgiveness. So they've been wonderful people that help our users down that path.
What do you think is in it for these people who sponsor the platform? Do they have a marketing objective to connect themselves to the issue of student debt, or is it simply a demographic that is appealing to them?
It's a mix of both. Sometimes, especially like a SoFi or a LendKey, they're definitely interested with the student loan aspect of that. While others, they do see our users as great ways to educate them about maybe a new product that's launching or an app that's available through that company or brand.
Now, your current approach is to look at debt, student debt, loan forgiveness. Is there a line extension that focuses on prizing for savings for things? Did I just come up with that? Your founder's going to have to thank me for that brilliant. You're going to have to thank me for that brilliant idea, because I'm sure you haven't thought of it before. You're welcome.
Yeah, we definitely understand. You know, there's definitely forefront conversations in the political world here in the United States about student loans being dismissed. So unfortunately, there's still a lot of different debt out there. There's health debt in the U.S., which is a big problem. So if student loan debt is completely dismissed one day, we have lots of areas we can pivot, and even savings, like you mentioned.
Interesting. Well, keep us up to speed on it and get yourself launched here in Canada. Seth, we appreciate you joining us.
All right, Bruce, I'll let you know when we're in Canada. Thank
Excellent.
You for having me.
Seth Beard is the chief marketing officer of an app called Givling. He joined us from Los Angeles, and while it isn't available yet here in Canada, it's such an interesting idea, and maybe someone will, I don't know, launch something like that here. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, certified financial planner and money coach Steve Bridge takes us through retirement myths and pitfalls. And Vanessa Vicaria is back with the Moolala questionnaire. If you want a little bit more Moolala, you can subscribe to the show. You can check out moolala.ca, and you will find there both a link to the podcast and also a link to other content that I work on for Money Sense, for CityLine, and various other things. You can also subscribe to the newsletter. Get that once a month or so. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
If you're a pre-retiree, is that a thing, a pre-retiree, someone who's not quite a retiree? You're probably thinking a little bit about how you're going to maximize your income in retirement. The answer is not simple, and that's because there's a whole bunch of complexity. There's myths, there are pitfalls that might be preventing you from making the most out of those savings that you worked so hard to cobble together. Steve Bridge is an advice-only financial planner, money coach at Money Coaches Canada. He's here to take us through some of the most common myths and pitfalls that he has seen in his work with retirement planning clients. Hello there, Steve.
Hello, Bruce.
There is a lot on this, and I think one of the views that we share, you and I share, is that there's so much focus on save, 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 and here's how you save, and here's how you save, and diversify and save, and low fees, and save, save, save. We spend very little time on what happens after that when you're in the decumulation phase. So on this program, we're trying to do more on that front, and I want to ask, first off, on the pitfall front, the first one that you flagged is not knowing how much you are going to spend or want to spend in retirement. This is a very, very tough question, and yet it is pivotal for the math. So how do people do it right?
100% pivotal. And it involves getting a little bit granular about what you're spending now and what's going to change in retirement. For example, you're not saving anymore. Your kids may be out of the house now. So you're spending less on groceries, for example. You might go down from two cars to one car. So things like that. There can be big changes.
Big changes. How do you reflect what some people call the three phases of retirement, the go-go, slow-go, and no-go, because spending can be quite different depending on how those phases go for you and how long they are?
Yeah, super individual, isn't it? Because it depends on what both spouses want to do. Do they want to travel, or do they want to relax, or do they want to do some consulting work? Do they have health issues? Do they anticipate needing more money for healthcare later on in life? You know, talk about, you know, family history, et cetera. So it is so individual, Bruce, to your specific situation. Yep.
One myth you highlight is you can't withdraw from your RRSPs before age 71. And I feel a little mixed about talking about this myth, because I would love for everybody to think you can never withdraw from your RRSPs so they don't use the money to buy a car or something like that. But it's true. You can withdraw the money at any time. There's just consequences. Take us through how a scenario in which someone might want to withdraw from their RRSPs. Maybe at 70, maybe well before that.
Yeah, and actually, I'm a big fan of starting withdrawing from RSPs right away. Like, let's say you retire at age 60. I say, let's start withdrawing from the RSPs then, or a defined contribution pension plan, which you have to turn into a LIF, as early as possible, because there's no other tax base of income, Bruce. You are getting that money out at the lowest possible tax rate that you will ever get it out.
Right.
And even if you don't need it, even if you don't need the money, put it into a TFSA, put it into an unregistered account, but use that as your spending money.
And of course, the 71 is the requirement that you convert your RSP into a RIF. What do you think, what do your clients not know that they should know, or that it would be helpful to know about the RIF?
About the RIF, really, it's the two big differences between the RSP and the RIF is that you cannot contribute to a RIF, and that it's mandatory to withdraw a certain percentage each year from a RIF. The other huge thing, Bruce, is that all of that money, when the last spouse passes, is taxable as income. If you have $500,000 in your RIF or RSP when you die, it's taxable as income. You're losing half the tax,
which is a link to the pitfall here about you get it out, but there's places you can put it. So you talk about the pitfall of not having diversified investment accounts, RSP, TFSA, non-registered account, which is not that common, and a spousal RSP. How does someone think through how many accounts they? I mean, as I riffed them off, as I reamed them off there, I was like, oh my god, that's a lot of accounts.
Yeah, and that's where, like, a professional could help you. But in an ideal scenario, you and your partner have equal money in RSPs, TFSAs, and you've both contributed to non-registered investment accounts in equal amounts. That's an ideal scenario. A spousal RSP can help if there's a big discrepancy in income between one partner and the other. But having money in all three of these accounts, and maybe some people have pensions as well. So if one person has a pension, maybe the other partner has more in their RSP. But what you want is you're setting yourself up to draw money equally at retirement.
One other pitfall here, taking CPP at age 60. And I've heard people have come up to me and said, I'm going to start taking it now because who knows how long I'm going to live. And I want that money. This is not the best financial decision.
It really isn't. And I hear all the time that people are going to take it at 60. You know, read any of those comment sections from online articles, right? And CPP is going to run out. I'm going to take it now in case I die. That's fine. If you've got health issues that you have a shortened life expectancy, fine, take it at 60. If you 100% need that money to survive, fine, take it at 60. But you are punishing yourself for the rest of your life by taking it at 60 because, as you know, you receive 0.6% less for each month that you take it before 65. That means 36% less each month the rest of your life if you take it at 60. And if you live to 90 or 95, that is a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. Now, I'm going to do your commercial for you. There is a lot of discussion about financial advisors, either fee only or those that charge a commission, whatever. The debate becomes much more focused after someone has retired, because it seems to me this is the area or this is the life stage in which the value of the advisor is so much higher.
100%. And I can't tell you, Bruce, how often I hear from my clients or other people saying that their advisor, Reed Investment Advisor, has told them to take their CPP at 60. And it drives me a little bit nuts. And I'm not saying it's because they'll collect commission for longer, but I'm not sure why you wouldn't help people reduce the amount of tax they're going to pay.
Yeah. Just to complete that thought, your assertion is if an advisor is not operating in the best interest of their client, they just want to keep the assets under management as long as they can.
Yeah. Absolutely. 100%. And a lot of people, this is why it goes to this ties into the myth of I can't take money from my RSP before 71. A lot of people think that because they've been told that.
Right. And really, they could. And, you know, I hope they aren't taking a reverse mortgage instead. But lots to focus on, Steve. Thank you for your time.
You're more than welcome, Bruce. Always a pleasure.
Steve Bridge is an advice-only financial planner. He's with Money Coaches Canada. And our focus was on some of the myths and pitfalls around retirement income. Time now for the Moolala questionnaire. Our guest, Vanessa Vicaria, she is the founder and CEO of The Math Guru, one of the coolest and grooviest math tutoring operations I've ever been to or heard of. Vanessa, the first thing that comes to your mind.
Okay.
How would you describe your money personality?
Do I have options?
This isn't a multiple choice test.
Okay.
Is that what you thought this was going to be,
test? It's fine. But that
one's... choose a word. Pretend you're not in math. Pretend you're in English.
Okay. Fun yet cautious.
And where do you think that comes from?
My parents.
What did they teach you growing up, either explicitly or implicitly?
to save early because compound interest is a real thing.
Magic. If I could give one financial concept to the population for them to imprint on their head, I would say compound interest.
You don't realize how much of a difference it makes.
It's the best. Okay. What is one of your strengths when it comes to managing your money? What are you good at?
I'm good at knowing when it's time to make a splurgy purchase and when not to.
Okay. And what is one behavior you'd say, I'm still working on that one?
I bulk buy. I see something on sale or something like that or some limited edition thing and I'm like, I should get like 20 of these and then they collect us.
Right. Lucky your tutoring company has a lot of space.
Exactly. Yes, yes.
What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures?
I probably like what everyone else would say, like really expensive lattes.
Really expensive lattes.
Like I'll spend like $7 on a latte. Like I'll kind of like be like, why am I doing this? But I do it every day.
How do you think about retirement savings? Are you saving for retirement?
Well, my dad told me I needed $4 million before I could retire.
Uh-huh. It's about right. It's about right. How are you?
I was really hoping you'd be like, that's insane.
No. Well, listen, no, I think he's on track. I'm only kidding. I don't know. I don't know how much you want to spend.
Oh my God.
Are you planning on working till you're 95?
Who knows what work really means by that point, but like I am saving for retirement as we speak.
Okay.
Like I'm already saving.
You're maxing out your RSP, you got TFSA.
Okay, I don't.
Don't ask for specifics.
I don't know what the specifics are, but like there are plans in place.
Do you have a financial advisor?
My father.
Thanks, Dad. Does he do it for a living?
No, but he is retired and he does it for entertainment. And he's like one of those people that like goes to all the conferences and he's always like mumbling about Warren Buffett. And like,
right. He's a big fan of mine. He's so excited that you're here with me because
really,
I'm such
is.
A really big deal.
He's mentioned it twice.
Hilarious. Oh my God. I'll autograph a book for him. What does financial freedom mean to you?
Okay. It means that it's hard to not think at the same time. Okay. It means that you can do whatever you want without really worrying about it. Yeah, that's what it means. It doesn't mean you're like, I have $1 million, I'm going to go buy like a plane. Not at all. Don't care. I just want to be able to do exactly what I want to do.
Do you think you will ever retire? And if you were to retire in whatever form that is, what would you do?
I really have been reading a lot about how the concept of retirement is what leads to depression. Mm. So like, I think my retirement would look different than someone else's. Like, I don't want to like stop working and like, just like, first of all, I don't hate my job. Like I love every single project I'm working on and I love projects. I love doing things. So like, no, I don't think I'll ever like not be working on something.
How do you think so for listeners who don't know, Vanessa's also a musician. She opened for Bon Jovi. She's like the real deal.
My band is called Goodnight Sunrise, by the way.
Did you just work that in?
Yeah.
I can't, but
sorry.
Goodnight Sunrise. I'm trying to think that through. Goodnight Sunrise
At 5 a.m. you were going to bed and you're like, oh my God, I stayed up way too late. The sun's rising.
Goodnight Sunrise. We've been there not since my 20s, but I do know in theory what you mean. How do you think about balancing the artist with the business person who runs a tutoring company?
I think of being an artist as, I think of business skills as an integral part of being an artist. And I would argue that I spend at least half my time managing Goodnight Sunrise and half my time managing the Math Guru. So
when you get the record deal and then the Grammy, what happens to the Math Guru?
It's going to keep going. I think really it'll like, I'll be involved to different degrees for the rest of my life. Who knows like what my involvement will look like, but I hope it like continues forever.
For listeners who have, well, not, most listeners probably have not been into your tutoring studio, but you should go. You should just stop by because it's so cool.
Thank you.
Is there a ritual that you perform in that space? It seems like the kind of place where there's, I don't know, like a blessed rock or like a diffuser or incense or something that gives us the zhuzh for good math.
So actually all of those are true. We do have crystals.
Really?
I have stage diffusers in every room and we light one incense stick when the studio opens every day.
Wow.
So you're correct.
I am correct. How do you connect that to the success of your students in learning
the
math?
The real ritual is the math lesson. Like the real ritual is like the latte when you get there, the treatment of you as a math or science learner and the math lesson. And the connection to me is really obvious because learning is a holistic process and we need to start treating it that way.
Vanessa, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Vanessa Vicaria, she is the founder and CEO of The Math Guru, but most important, even more important than that, she is the lead singer?
I am the lead singer.
She is the lead singer of Good Night Sunrise, available on Spotify. Then they'll get 3 cents. Go online and actually buy the thing on iTunes or something like that. Thank you so much, Vanessa. That is our show for today. You can subscribe to this show on any of your podcast platforms. If you do go to Spotify, forget about downloading my podcast and instead download Vanessa's music. That's much smarter. Be sure to connect with me or Vanessa on social media. Vanessa, what's your social media handle?
I'm at The Math Guru.
At The Math Guru or at Bruce Celery. That's me. You can also send me an email to ask@moolala.ca. Thanks so much for joining us and have a great day.